Let's go.
Oh, no.
Do you
want to
start? I'll let you.
I'm excited and I feel relaxed and I'm ready to party!
Let's say sorry.
You don't need to do that. You don't need to apologize. It's a fucked up female habit. You don't need to be sorry for anything ever.
Can you guess what every woman's worst nightmare is?
I don't have rage issues!
I have nothing to prove to you.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I say when it comes to stardom and Lauren, there are no accidents.
Hi, Karen Peterson.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Citizen Dame, the podcast where at least one of us is sitting in the middle of just like a fucking windstorm, apparently. I am your host, Lauren Humphreys Brooks, and with me, as always, is Karen Peterson. Hello, Karen.
Hello.
How are you doing today, Karen?
You know, I'm doing all right. It is cloudy and it's supposed to rain here today, so.
Yeah, we're overcast and very, very windy. The weather here has been just bizarre the past few days, but we have actually reached spring, it seems like, which is good.
Yay.
Always nice. Spring in New York is always an interesting time. I could tell that it's spring because all of my congestion has just risen. It's like, oh yeah, that's yeah. Right. Allergies. Oh, it's warm. It's sunny. Allergies.
Yesterday, one day this week, I went to work and I was just like, maybe I should go home. My throat's kind of sore and I feel a little bit congested. And then I was like, oh, wait, there's like so much pollen in the sky. That's why.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah,
exactly. Well, we are going to, I'm excited about this. I think you're very excited about this because this is a director that you've wanted to talk about for a while. So today we are going to talk about the films of Penny Marshall. And if you do not know who Penny Marshall is at this point, like she's made some of the most iconic comedies, I think. Like she's kind of right up there with people like Nancy Meyers and Nora Ephron in terms of just the how iconic her work has become. So if you do not know who Penny Marshall is, I'm sorry, like this is going to be very confusing. But even if you don't know her name, you've definitely seen at least one of her films. She directed films like A League of Their Own, Big, both of which we're going to talk about today. She also directed Jumpin' Jack Flash, which we will be discussing today. Awakenings, Renaissance Man, The Preacher's Wife, and Riding in Cars with Boys. So actually not a huge filmography, but a very influential filmography.
Yeah. And this is after she got a start in acting. She mm-hmm. She was from the Bronx, if anybody wasn't sure by listening to her talk. But when it was time for college, she wanted to get out of the city and go out west. And so she ended up going to school in, I think, New Mexico and wanting to lose her accent, which she joked a lot that her friends failed her in that endeavor because yep. That never went away. But eventually she went to Los Angeles and her brother, Gary Marshall, was already, you know, he was a writer. He was doing some comedies at the time, TV comedies, and she ended up getting cast in The Odd Couple, which was a TV series based on the movie. And mm-hmm. So she had a recurring role in that before she landed a kind of a guest spot with Cindy Williams in Happy Days. And their characters, Laverne and Shirley, were so popular in this guest arc that they got their own spinoff show, Laverne and Shirley, which was a big part of my childhood. I loved that show. but after it ended, she was just kind of not really sure what to do with herself. She's very, her acting skills are limited. She was very funny, but there wasn't a whole lot she could do from after Laverne and Shirley left. And it was actually Whoopi Goldberg who convinced her to switch over into directing and try it out. And so she took over. Her first film, she took over from another director a few weeks into the shoot, and that is Jumpin' Jack Flash.
So, yeah, exactly. So let's talk about Jumpin' Jack Flash just to start off with, since this is her first feature film. And she described it as jumping into feature films was like cramming 4 years of college into one semester, which I would imagine. So if you've never made a film before and you're making a pretty big film, this is not like a small student production or a short film or anything like that. This is like a big kind of action comedy, right?
Yeah, and like 20th Century Fox, I think.
Yeah, with a major star.
Yeah, produced it.
With mm-hmm. a major star. Whoopi Goldberg is a major star at this point. And so this is definitely a big learning curve would be there. So this was a film that I had never seen before. I had heard things about it, and it kind of has got a lot of negative press when it came out. It was panned. It had a modest success. It wasn't a box office failure or anything, but it wasn't like a huge film, and a lot of people really disliked it. It's definitely had a resurgence, I think, in more recent years, where people are actually talking about it again and being like, hey, this film was actually pretty good.
I think it's around the time Penny Marshall died. She passed away in 2018. Mm-hmm. And I think that was kind of the point where people started reappraising some of her work. And this is one that benefited from that.
Well, and one of the things with her films, and she's similar, that's why I brought up people like Nora Ephron and Nancy Myers, is that she makes this particular kind of bubbly comedy, I guess would be the way that I would describe it. Very like, not terribly serious, not films that are grappling with apparently serious issues. And we can discuss whether or not A League of Their Own really qualifies in the same way. But there's that emphasis on comedy throughout. And I think that that's one of the things that kind of pushes her to sort of be sidelined in a similar way to people like Myers or Ephron, in that she's a female director who is at the same time making pretty straightforward mainstream comedies. And there's a tendency to be like, well, she's not a great filmmaker, right? She's not really important in the same way because of the style of film that she's making. And I think that's one of the things that's happening in terms of Jumpin' Jack Flash, and maybe one of the reasons why it got reappraised after her death, because it is a very kind of 1980s action comedy. It's incredibly 1980s. It's so 1980s that watching this film, I was like, literally everyone in the 80s is in this film. All the people from the 80s. Like, so this was a film that was released in 1986. It's the year I was born, everybody. and it's just so dominated by not just by Whoopi Goldberg, but by all of these actors that you're like, oh, there's Jim Belushi and there's Michael McKean and there, like, Tracy Ullman is there.
These are all people she had been working with up to that point in various capacities. So it's not like they just came out of nowhere. It was like she was friends with Michael McKean from Laverne and Shirley. Mm-hmm. And she knew John Lovitz from Saturday Night Live. And he actually had to audition for that role. I didn't realize it. I was reading some stuff on it yesterday. So it was like she was kind of doing the thing where she's collecting people that she knows, some she mm-hmm. didn't, but it's like, it's one of those things that I really admire when filmmakers do that, where they're like, hey, let's all go up together, you know?
Yeah, let's all get together and make a movie. And it feels like that in a lot of ways, that it's like, oh, you know, there's John Lovitz, there's Phil Hartman has a small part. Mm-hmm. Carol Kane, it plays Whoopi Goldberg's best friend, and she's just delightful. Like,
yep. I love her.
So this is a story about Teresa Terry Doolittle, played by Whoopi Goldberg, who works at the First National Bank and is kind of a computer whiz and is represented as being very kind of spacey and all over the place, but also very, very competent in her job, more competent than pretty much anyone else. And she winds up getting a communique from a British intelligence agent who calls himself Jumpin' Jack Flash, who essentially manages to hack into her terminal and then begins communicating with her. And he says that he is trapped in somewhere in Eastern Europe and he needs her help to get him out. And then this kind of launches this major kind of comedy espionage thing, where she is trying to figure out ways to help him, only communicating with him through this computer. So, Karen, why don't you start us off on this one? This was the first time I'd seen this film. I was just massively entertained by it. But what are your initial feelings on Jumpin' Jack Flash?
Yeah, I find this such an entertaining movie. This was one that actually showed on TV a lot when I was a kid. And it wasn't until I was a little bit older that I found out people hated it. And I was like, what? That movie's hilarious. What are you talking about? And so I'm glad that it finally started to get some more respect, because it's a very funny movie. And I love how much it just pulls from all the 80s like espionage movies, not just comedies, but some of it with the comedies too, but especially like just spy movies, you know. And it plays with that genre so well, you know. The Jumpin' Jack Flash character, I mean, that's from song lyrics and from the Rolling Stones song. And then like that's like the song is used for clues for things, and I love the coincidence of how, or maybe a coincidence, maybe not a coincidence, of how this British spy ends up communicating with like the smartest computer person in this bank department, mm-hmm. and who also not only is really smart and with computers, but also happens to be a total pop culture nerd who would understand some of the references that he's throwing out and like the clues that he's hiding and everything. And I love her character too, this character of Terry.
Yeah.
And how she lives alone, and she really does. She spends her evenings watching classic films. How can we hate that? But also she's just so, she cares about her friends and she takes care of people. And all of that is part of why when somebody seems to be reaching out and needing help, she's just like, you know what, stranger, I don't know you, but I can't just not help you, you know? So it feels like it's even though it's silly and goofy, it feels like there's actually some real thought and intention behind so much of the character and the story choices.
Absolutely. One of the things I really liked is that, you know, we've talked about the idea of pure cinema, right? Telling a lot about a character without necessarily including dialogue initially. And that's one of the things that we get with Terry, actually, at the beginning. We see her apartment. We see the film posters and the books that she's reading and everything. And so you establish her as, like you say, someone who is very much connected to not just pop culture, but media culture generally. Mm-hmm. Who like, and who also, you know, because of those connections to classic films, etc., she kind of works herself into this narrative where she's like, oh, I know what happens now, you know, I know this story. She's reading, you know, spy novels, she's watching, you know, Casablanca and things like that, so she knows this stuff, right? She knows it in kind of an intimate way. But also that the whole interpersonal relationships that we see her having before we actually get into the espionage bit, so her connections with her coworkers, but and the way in which they depend on her, and it's obvious that she like is just a very friendly and very open and very helpful person with all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, fixing the chair for the pregnant lady and talking with her other friend about, you know, her dating life and things like that. But then also the connections that she makes with the people in her computer that she communicates with, because her job is to do these money transfers. And so she's talking with people in France and in Britain and all over the place. But what we find out is that she's not just talking to them about like money transfers. She's talking to them about like their love lives and what's going on with them today. So like she has these connections with people that she just forms as a part of like her natural self. And that all gets shown to us very quickly, actually, at the beginning of the film, so that we know who this woman is going into the actual espionage bit. So I think that you're right, that the script and the way that Marshall films everything very much feels like, okay, this is, you know, we're grounded in the character. We know who the character is. We know what her talents are. And we know that those talents are going to be used in this, you know, quirky espionage story.
Yeah. I mean, obviously this is not a perfect movie or anything like that, but I think that what we really see, very quickly early on in the movie, but then when you step back and look at the totality of it, you really see Marshall from the beginning as someone who really understands story and character. And that is so important. And that's something that she carries through mm-hmm. with all of her films. And she just gets progressively better and better at it. And I think some of that probably came from, I mean, she's very much part of a like a cinema family. I think her mom and dad are both in this movie, actually. But it's also, I think, from working in TV, I think helps give you some of that experience even more than movies can sometimes. Mm-hmm. And which she had not only been on TV as a star, but she also had gotten a little bit of experience with some directing and being in the writer's rooms and things too. And I think that all contributed to just having this, she goes in kind of, it's a crash course in movie making, but she didn't come in like with no knowledge or vocabulary. It's not like she had to start learning her ABCs, yeah, you know, and then write a sonnet at the end. It was, she came in with some experience and knowledge already.
Exactly. And like you say, in story and also just in comedy. And this is someone who's been in comedy since the beginning of her career, really. Mm-hmm. And comedy in itself it's difficult. Comedy is actually a hard thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think works really well in all of her films is that they are comedies that are not just setups for a gag. And you get that in, like, so there are obvious setups in Jumpin' Jack Flash. There's obviously, like, you know, the phone booth scene.
Mm-hmm.
Which is funny. It's fucking hilarious. So like, funny. I loved that scene so much. I love the idea of Whoopi Goldberg being dragged through New York in a phone booth and the way that New Yorkers react to that. And it's very much like, oh, it's New York. Like, yeah, it is. Yeah, that's a woman being dragged in a phone booth. All right. Well, probably some reason for that. But so you get to that point, right? But it makes sense within the context of the plot. It's not just like, okay, we're going to set up for this funny gag of Whoopi Goldberg being dragged through New York in a phone booth. It's integral to the plot and it's integral to the comedy. So it isn't just like, you know, set up gag. It is actually a part of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
And very clever. Same thing with like her breaking into the British Embassy, the computer room, and then her dress getting shredded, like all of that stuff. You know, it's funny and it's funny to watch her. And Whoopi Goldberg is a fantastic physical comedian as well as a fast talking dame, I guess.
I think that's part of it too, with Marshall telling this story, making this movie. She also understands her stars and what they're capable of and lets them do their thing. You know, she doesn't try to rein Whoopi in or hold her back. It's very like she really lets her use the physical comedy as well as the intelligent comedy.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's not well, the other thing that I liked is that again, this is the kind of story where this character could have so easily been made the butt of a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And she isn't at any point. Like, she's strange. She is like, doesn't quite fit into a lot of spaces, but she is not, she isn't someone that's being made fun of. She, like, the people that make fun of her when they do, like, she clocks them pretty quickly. And she proves that, you know, she's much more capable and smarter than people think she is.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that right off the bat, like, because it's established what her capabilities are. This is not, you know, some hapless person who gets thrust into this espionage game. This is actually someone who is very, very competent in what she's doing, and she uses all of that.
Yeah.
I did want to talk about briefly the Jumpin' Jack Flash section with like the actual song, because it's so 1980s, first of all, because I'm sitting there going like, well, why don't you just look up the lyrics? I was like, oh, you can't really look up the lyrics, can you?
Like, they didn't even used to print them in the like jackets of the CDs and stuff, or they weren't CDs at the time that this came out. But yeah, goes about getting those lyrics is exactly how it was.
Yeah, figuring out the lyrics to Jumpin' Jack Flash. And there's definitely like, yeah, that's an odd song. You know, I was crowned with a spike right through my head. What? What are you talking about, man? I just really enjoyed watching that and like do her, you know, impressions of, oh, it's the Jagger dance. It was very clever, although I did immediately that they said the key is, so it's like, it's the key, what key is Jumpin' Jack Flash?
Yeah, but yeah, how she's getting lyrics wrong and she's like, that can't be right. And she goes back and looks at it again. And yeah.
It's just funny. Like, I just found it very funny.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a, like you say, it's not a perfect film. And I think that it kind of stutters in terms of pacing and stuff like that. I really like the fact that, spoiler alert, like she kind of gets the guy in the end, and I really enjoy that. I like this whole, like, again, that relationship that develops just through the two of them having this communication on the computer.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things I like about that, though, is they do have this connection, and there comes a point where he's asking her to do something, and it's to go to the anniversary thing at the embassy. And he says, do you have an evening jacket? And that's when she realizes that he thinks that Terry is a guy's name and that she is not she. And so she kind of has it out with him a little bit, like, dude, I'm capable. And he's just like, no, I can't ask you to do this. And so it does kind of get into that a little bit of these expectations of, oh, this is men's work. And she's just like, screw you, man. No.
Yeah, it's very smart. It's and I like the fact that they address that like he doesn't realize that she's a woman for a good bit of the story. And then when he does, he's like, no, goodbye. It's just like, what? You just like asked me to do all this shit and I've done it. I've accomplished all of the things you want me to do. And now you're just like, oh no, you're a girl.
Right. Well, but what I like too is that there's kind of this sense, because they're only communicating in basically text messaging and or direct messages, whatever. And there's sort of this, it's like he gets kind of protective of her. And so that's again laying the groundwork and having something pay off later. There's sort of this. Later on, it feels like, or maybe this is a repeat viewing thing, I don't know, but it's like, okay, it's not that he doesn't think she's capable, it's that he now cares and doesn't want anything to happen to her. So
he definitely cares about her, and he apologizes also when he finds out that she's a woman, and she's like, well, fuck you, like, if you don't think I'm capable just because I'm a woman after I've done all of this shit. And then he's like, okay, I'm really sorry, like, here's what you need to do, you know, I shouldn't have said that, all of that stuff. It's just like, it's this nice little element that gets worked in there and kind of highlights, you know, her competence and the fact that, you know, some of those elements about, like, when you just make the assumption that someone is a male, oh, they're really capable, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why would a guy be any more capable than she is just because of, like, a guy in the same role, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So, yes, it is a very fun film. I'm glad that I got to watch it. This was one that I think got repeated quite a bit on places like Comedy Central. So I'd seen bits and pieces of it. But never actually the full film. So it was a lot of fun to watch. And is available to rent on places like Amazon. I highly recommend it. So let's move on to some
By the way, sorry, yeah. Really quick. This was her only R-rated film.
Really?
Yep.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Why was it R-rated? Is it just because swearing?
I mean, the 80s were really sensitive about that stuff.
So I was gonna say, because there's no sex. There's like
no
there's
sex. There's really there's no violence.
There's a little bit of violence.
There's no bloody violence.
Yeah, exactly. It's not. It's very actiony violence. Mm-hmm. Like it's not. No one gets dismembered or anything like that.
Right.
And it does have literally everyone from the 80s is in this movie.
Yes.
Which is also true for the next film that we're going to talk about. All of her films, literally everyone from the 80s are in these films.
Mm-hmm.
So the next one we're going to talk about is Big from 1988. So 2 years later, I was 2 years old, just so that everyone could keep track of my age as we go through these films. And this film, I mean, I'm kind of like, do you need me to give the synopsis of this film? Has anyone not seen Big at this point? Like, I mean, maybe the youths have not. This might be like more of a Gen X and millennial thing.
It probably is, yeah.
It stars Tom Hanks as a boy, Josh, who wishes on the Zoltar machine that he can be big. And he wakes up the next morning and he has literally become big. He has grown into an adult. He is now Tom Hanks, very young, cute Tom Hanks. And he's got to deal with that, including all of the madness that goes along with it. And he eventually becomes like a major player at FAO Schwartz. I forgot how often FAO Schwartz gets worked into these films in like the 80s and 90s. I went to FAO Schwartz like once as a child because of like Home Alone and shit like that.
It wasn't just where you went on Saturdays. What?
Yeah. And so like he winds up becoming this brilliant marketer of toys and stuff like that. And in the process winds up in a relationship, which I think we should discuss at some point, but this is again, a very sort of straightforward, really big, famous, well-known, beloved 1980s comedy, and very rightfully so. It's very funny. It is very like well-paced. Tom Hanks is charming as fuck. Everybody is charming as fuck, but Tom Hanks does a great job with it. I liked reading the different people who were considered, who included like Kevin Costner, Steve Guttenberg, Warren Beatty, Dennis Quaid, Albert Brooks, John Travolta wanted to play the part, Sean Penn was considered, Robert De Niro was actually cast. This is the one that makes me go like, I want there to be an alternate universe so that I can see the version of Big starring Robert De Niro. Like, I just really, really, because that would be a different film.
I mean, even, is there like a screen test, like video out there somewhere that we can have access to?
You know? Exactly. I want to see this. Like, because, you know, Robert De Niro in the 80s. Okay. Like, yeah, I could get maybe. But like, I want to fucking see that, man, because it is, that's different. That is a different role for him. Yeah. And definitely different from Tom Hanks.
he was a little old by that time, though. That's the funny thing.
Yeah, he would have been significantly older. And like Tom Hanks is so baby faced in this movie. Like he looks so young and sweet, right? So he gets at that kind of childishness that is because Josh is supposed to be, you know, 12-year-old boy. But yeah, De Niro, like how would De Niro have played a 12-year-old boy? Mm-hmm. That would have been interesting. So what would you like to talk about with this film, Karen? It is, I mean, it's such an iconic film. I feel like just talking about like, oh, it's so funny. It's like, yeah, it is. It just is.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would like to say just a couple of facts about the movie. It was nominated for 2 Academy Awards. This was Tom Hanks's first Oscar nomination. He was nominated for Best Actor, lost to Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. And this also was nominated for screenplay. So Gary Ross and Ann Spielberg were nominated for that. And then this was Penny Marshall became the first female director to have a film gross over $100 million. So this was at the time the highest grossing film a female director had done. And one of the highest grossing movies, I think, of 1988. So I just had to mention a couple of those things. But yeah, I really love this movie. Yes, there is a big glaring problem that did not age well that we need. Well, it wasn't even okay at the time, but that we need to talk about. But we'll set that aside for now, because I think that this is. I mean, that's a interesting jump to go from Jumpin' Jack Flash to Big, and the difference in the movie, not the style, but there's just such a, you can really see the growth and maturity in this. Like Jumpin' Jack Flash is a lot of fun. I love it. And it's developed well, but Big just feels like it's on a whole other level. And it's developed well again. Like it really shows Penny Marshall has such a good handle on how to develop a story and how to unfold events. And really, really give you everything you need to know about characters pretty early on. So it starts off with Josh and his best friend, Billy, when they are 12-year-old boys. And you see them just kind of going through their day and just this really close friendship that they have. But also Josh, you know, he is close with his family too, and he has a baby sister, and his parents take him to the carnival, and that's where he gets really embarrassed in front of the girl that he likes. And so all these things, you really see where this 12-year-old boy who's just feeling so embarrassed and so awkward. He's short and he feels uncomfortable about that. And also he loves video games, you know, just, you get all this about him. So you understand that moment when he walks up to that Zoltar machine and he's just feeling so sad, and how just kind of out of desperation, he makes this wish that he just thinks is silly and is never going to happen. It's not like he does that actually believing that it's going to work. And then it does. But I also love how we get another chance to get to know Josh through Tom Hanks, because now he's thrust into this situation where he has to go. First of all, his mom thinks that her son has been kidnapped. Yeah. And there's some strange man in her house, which I love that scene so much. I think actually we have to also talk about mom in a second. But yeah, he ends up kind of having to hide out in the city until they can figure out a way to get him out of this situation. And that's where we kind of get to know Josh in another way, as this kid who, like, how does he handle a crisis and what does he do? And and I think it's a very funny movie, but I think it's also a really sweet and tender one as well.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I think a lot of it comes down to the way that Marshall directs and the way that Hanks in particular plays the part. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just like any 12-year-old boy. It's this very particular 12-year-old boy. And you feel like he's embodying this character.
Yeah.
And all of those things, just like, okay, so it's kind of like a fun exercise to start out with. It's like, okay, if a 12-year-old suddenly became an adult, how would they react to having to exist in the adult world? Mm-hmm. Right, so like, yes, his mom freaks out, as she would. Right. Who would not freak out if your 12-year-old was missing and there's this random man in the house
claiming to be him?
Yeah, exactly. And but then also like him trying to figure out things like how to get an apartment. Mm-hmm. And then when he begins to be like, okay, now I'm like solid on my feet, what do you do? Well, of course, like, you buy all of the cool shit that you want to buy because you're 12 years old. You don't really think about all of the adult things that you actually have to deal with because you're 12. And also when you're 12, a lot of the time, particularly if you grow up like middle class, etc., a lot of the time you think that, oh, adults just have it all figured out, and like, oh, all of this money is suddenly coming towards me. I'm rich, right? I can just spend it on anything, and you're going to spend it on candy and toys.
I was gonna say, I love, just on that note, I love the scene where he's working at the toy company and in the data processing department, and he gets his first paycheck and he's like $187, and John Lovitz is like, I know, doesn't that suck? And he's just like over the moon. He's just like, I can't believe it. He's never seen this much money in his life, you know?
Exactly. I remember the first time I had the
bank and cash it.
I remember the first time I had $100, like, it's just like, oh my God, I'm rich. I've never been richer before. Like, and yeah, of course, when you're an adult, you're like, that's not a lot of money. And like, even in the 80s, that's not a lot of money. But when you're a kid, like, that is the most money anyone has ever had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I love how it's done. It feels so believable. One of the ways that, just going back to what you were saying about how this doesn't just feel like Tom Hanks is a random 12-year-old. This is a very specific 12-year-old boy. One of the ways that they did that actually was a lot of scenes, especially where it was physical comedy. They had David Moscow, who played young Josh, they had him act out stuff and film it. And then Tom would watch the recordings, and then he would just learn kind of how to do it, how to kind of replicate the physicality that David Moscow did, so that it really does. It's like, this is what this young kid would do if he were in a grown up body. It's those really smart things like that, well, that make it feel so tangible and real.
Yeah, he gets at that kind of awkwardness of that age, that like, you know, and so you're also in a new body where you're a full grown man, and has and he hasn't really gotten to go through puberty yet, but suddenly he's an adult man, and all of that stuff. And but you like Hanks definitely gets at that physicality of like not being quite comfortable in your own body, not being quite certain how everything works, essentially. That is very much like, you know, I've never been a 12-year-old boy, I've been a 12-year-old girl, but it's very much like, you know, attached to that kind of that memory of adolescence, I guess. And it makes perfect sense that, like, yeah, he's a little bit gangly, he's a little bit like not quite certain, a little awkward, not totally, you know, in possession of himself, very much. And that's one of the things that makes him so charming as an adult as well, because we don't expect that from grown men. And so let's talk about the central issue of this film, which is his relationship with Susan, played by Elizabeth Perkins. And generally they handle it very well, but there's definitely some problematic elements that simply come down to the fact that this is still being represented as a child in a man's body. And some of this stuff, some of his discomfort and his confusion is definitely played off for laughs. So it's not, and it's one of those instances where you can't really grapple with the actual issues there in a comedy situation. So they couldn't really address some of the problematics of this relationship. And so it winds up being one of those times that you kind of have to watch with part of your brain turned off a little bit in order to be able to enjoy the film.
I would agree with that. I think 'cause, well, because I mean, there's a very, very clear moment. We don't see it happen, but we very much are given all the signs that they do eventually sleep together, which obviously that's a big problem. This is after his 13th birthday, so he's not 12 anymore, but that does not make it okay. And she has no idea. And I do think that there's an interesting moment once she finally fight when he tells her the truth, and she doesn't believe it at first, but then she kind of comes to where she has to accept that he's not lying to her. And you can really see, and this is credit to Elizabeth Perkins, you can really see kind of that realization wash over her of exactly what has happened, and that a little bit of that, like, oh my gosh, that horror. But that the thing is that it's not just the fact that they have slept together that is the problem. I think I think everything from the moment that they really start to hang out, it's that he's been promoted because of a fateful Saturday afternoon at FAO Schwartz, which I do love that scene.
It's a great scene. The piano scene.
When he plays with the president of the company, he plays, you know, heart and soul and chopsticks on the giant piano. But anyway, so he gets promoted. He's now VP. He goes to the company party. He runs into Susan. They take off together, and she ends up coming over to his apartment. She has expectations of what's going to happen. He is not thinking that way yet. And so just seeing the innocence of him, it is. It's intended to be funny. We're supposed to laugh at it. And some of it is kind of funny because it's just like, oh, kids just don't get it. But there is a bigger problem, more problematic aspect there, which is very much that he doesn't understand. And there's a grown woman that he's inviting into his apartment. And we really can't talk about that because she doesn't know. And he doesn't know that she needs to know.
Well, and that's the thing. It's less about what is actually going on between the characters and more about the way that the film plays it. And that, because it is intended to be funny. It is, it's not, they're not going to treat this in a really serious way. And they do treat of it in like the characters wind up treating him in a serious way. Like it's no one's fault, really. Like it's not her fault. She hasn't, as far as she knows, he is an adult man because he is, right? And it's not his fault because he's a child.
But I also think, 'cause there's a world where it's like, well, maybe this part of the story doesn't even need to be there because, you know, for Josh, it's really, he's just trying to kill time. He's got 6 weeks until they can find out where the Zoltar machine is, track it down, get him turned back to normal. But And so it's like, do we need this relationship with Susan? And in some ways, no. Yeah. But also, it becomes so complicated for him that when he finally has that opportunity to, when Billy comes back and is like, hey, the list is here, let's go find this thing and turn and bring you back home. By this point, Josh has gone through this maturity much faster than he should have had to. But he's very much like, well, I have a job. I have a life here. I don't, like, he has to actually decide, does he want to go home? So it kind of creates this conflict. So it's interesting because it's like, yes, that's a very problematic storyline, and it would be nice to be able to just like extract that from the film, but it also, it's so entangled in this other complication that it's hard to just completely pull it out. You'd have to still find another way to give Josh that complication besides just, oh, I like my job, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I think that they could have handled it in a way that made it a little, like, maybe the relationship a little less sexual. You know, just so that, because it would be understandable that, like, because he's a 12-year-old boy, he's had crushes, right? That's what we see at the beginning of the film.
Right.
So him having a crush, or him developing, you know, even having a crush on an older woman, right? That's not unusual for an adolescent boy. It's the fact that, like, her misunderstanding of it and his innocence, which he has to be innocent at the age of 12. But then the fact that it escalates to the degree that it does, I think that's one of the issues that the film uses, but can't actually grapple with in the space, mm-hmm. because that's not what the story is about.
Right.
And because of that, it's like, it gets increasingly uncomfortable. And I do think that, you know, we often talk about, you know, you can't completely gender swap some of these things, but if we were talking about a 12-year-old girl who turns into an adult in the same situation and has a relationship with an adult man, no one would be okay with what the film does in that instance.
Right.
Really, we shouldn't really be okay with it that it's a boy and that it's Tom Hanks.
Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah.
So it's, but one of those also, that's like,
yeah. Yeah. And yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you kind of, but it's like, it also, the movie itself is so good. It's not, again, you can't just easily extract that from this entanglement of the story and the character development, but also the movie is so good that it's, you can just, yeah, kind of close your eyes and just kind of, okay, we're just going to skip right through that. It doesn't make the movie unwatchable is what I'm trying to say.
No, yeah, exactly. And I do think a lot of that is also in the way that the characters handle it. And then the fact that, like, this is not an adult woman assaulting a 12-year-old boy. Like, that's not what's happening.
The truth is, if Susan knew, like, if she actually had any way of knowing that he was a kid, she never would have done this. Never.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that some of the point within the context of the film is that he's different. He's sweet. He's kind, you know, he's caring. He doesn't think of everything, you know, it's kind of like some of those tropes about men as well, that, you know, he doesn't think of everything in terms of sex and stuff like that. And because of that, she's attracted to the fact that he is such a nice guy, basically.
Right.
And what the film is doing is that, you know, he's one of the reasons why he's a nice guy is because he's 12.
Yeah. I love, though, with Susan and how she does have this relationship with this guy, Paul, played by John Hurt, who's an asshole, total corporate, like, just jerk. And he's so jealous. Like, where did this guy come from? He came from data processing. He gets promoted to VP. Okay, yes, I understand. I would have questions too. But he just takes that as such a threat, like a personal threat, you know? And the way that he handles things is so ridiculous and just increasingly immature. And I love the scene where Susan and Paul are kind of fighting when they're breaking up. And Paul says, what does Baskin have that I don't? And Susan just looks at him and says, he's a grown-up. I love that so much, because it's like, there is sometimes something that happens when men grow up where they get less mature and less kind and less, you know,
Well, yeah,
nice that, to be around.
That's just it. He's a nice guy. Like that's mm-hmm. that's the thing. And part of the joke is that he's 12.
Right.
But he's still a nice guy, and he hasn't yeah. had to go through a lot of that male toxicity.
Right.
And then I mean we could talk about all that means as well, but that's kind of, it's just like me be a nice guy kind of mm-hmm. thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you're nice, you might actually get ahead more and you might actually be a happier person.
Yeah. I do think the movie is also trying to give us the impression though too that Josh is just a sweet kid, and he probably yeah. always will be.
Yes, and I hope that his experience also leads him to becoming that adult, that Tom yeah. Hanks, you know?
Yeah.
So let's jump forward to a very different Tom Hanks role, in which he is not the lead character, although he is definitely an important one. So moving ahead to 1992 and A League of Their Own, which again, you know, talk about fucking iconic films. I mean, this one is just... there are no more iconic baseball movies than, I mean, League of Their Own is one of the top ones, definitely.
This was the second film by a female director to gross over $100 million.
Good for you, Penny Marshall. You're doing good. So this is 1992. So let's see, I would have been six, I think.
I was in high school.
I did not see A League of Their Own when it came out. However, I did play baseball from, I forget how old I was when I started. I did not play women's baseball. I played baseball on a baseball team with primarily boys. But there was definitely like when I finally saw this one, was just like, yeah, yeah. Although sliding through bases in a fucking skirt, that sounds like truly horrible. I'm glad that this film actually does address this.
Read something where I'm trying to remember which actress it was that did that slide where she has that giant bruise on her hip, on her thigh.
Yeah,
apparently that bruise stayed for over a year.
Wow.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just like, and baseball, like the dirt around it's not dirt, it's like usually gravel or something.
Yeah,
like that,
it's like so sand, it isn't, and clumpy,
yeah, and yeah. you're running full tilt and you have to, and then you have to slide. And you know, I even when I played as a child, I slid before and I would like tear the bottoms of my baseball pants. Like it's not it I just I can't imagine it. That would hurt like a bitch.
Yeah.
Ugh. So if you don't know what A League of Their Own is about, I can't help you. Like at this point, come on, guys, like you have to know. So it's about women's baseball when, you know, Major League Baseball is essentially having to be put on hold to a certain degree because all of the men are off at war. It's in 1943. And so they decide that we're going to have a women's league. And all the girls are going to play baseball. And so this film deals pretty explicitly with a lot of the sexism of the time period, but also the female camaraderie and this whole idea about these women who have, you know, are kind of being put into positions where they're kind of taking over a lot of the roles that the men have, but they're also being mocked for it. They're also being treated badly for it because they're trying, because it's not just they're actual athletes. It's not just, oh, we're going to put on a show for the boys. It's they are actually baseball players and serious baseball players. And so they're struggling to be taken seriously. It's just such an iconic film. Gina Davis kind of leads everything and she is wonderful. I love the way that Marshall balances the relationships with the women, between the women, because it's very much about the women. Tom Hanks is kind of there as the manager, or the coach to sort of run everything, but so much of the focus is about the interpersonal relationships again between the women, and particularly between the two sisters, but Dottie and
Kit.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on, you said you've seen this film 1,000 times.
Oh yeah.
Why have you seen this film 1,000 times, Karen?
Oh, because it's just so perfect. First of all, I'm a huge baseball fan. And, you know, I mean, I love Field of Dreams. I really like For the Love of the Game. But there's just something about about A League of Their Own that it feels like they made a baseball movie for me, you know, like at the time in 1992 when this came out, I actually didn't know much about the AAGPBL, but I think I got that right. But this really kind of unlocked that for me, and I really wanted to learn more, because when I was a kid, if you wanted to play ball, the choices were Little League or Mary Miss softball, and the girls played mm-hmm. softball. They did not play baseball. Occasionally you'd get a girl who was particularly, you know, particularly good, and they'd let her play in Little League, but in my town, mostly it was like, no, girls played softball. And I had a terrible experience with that, which we don't need to get into right now, but I will tell that story another time. But I grew up going to baseball games. I loved baseball, and getting to see and learn that there was once an entire league where women got to play professional baseball just really, it just did something for me. And then this movie itself it's very funny, but it's also very emotional. There's so many great moments. The relationship between Gina Davis and Lori Petty as these sisters, Dottie and Kit, the competition that is really coming from Kit. Dottie's not fueling that. She doesn't even intend for any of it to happen. Mm-hmm. She's kind of clueless about it because she's the older sister that has had everything kind of just happen for her. Everything's been easy, and she doesn't understand what it's like through her sister's eyes. And then seeing best friends and seeing people who don't know each other, and just seeing the way women lift up and support each other and cheer each other on. There's nothing to dislike about this movie. It's such a wonderful experience every time I watch it.
Yeah, I mean, I put in the notes of the on our agenda, perfect movie, no notes. Yeah. Like there's not much to criticize about it, honestly. It's very well paced, it's very empathetic. Mm-hmm. And you know, and it's so many iconic lines, you know, no crying in baseball, that kind of thing.
Which is hilarious because men freaking sob at Field of Dreams and whatever. That's part of why that's so funny.
Men
cry sports, in the World Series.
Men take sports so fucking seriously and have so many emotions around it. And then it's like, oh, there's no crying in baseball. It's just like, no, there definitely is. There definitely is. You guys, like, come on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so much crying in baseball.
To your point, yeah, I ran into so I played baseball. I didn't play Little League, but I played whatever it was for kids. It wasn't T-ball, but it was one up. And I played that throughout my childhood and adolescence. And then it came to a point where it was like, oh, now the boys go to Little League and the girls go to softball. And I was like, but I don't like softball. I don't want to play softball. And I really just wish, I think that legally they could not have stopped me from trying out for Little League, but I don't think I would have made it. I was very much discouraged from, like, even, you know, and I don't know if I just wasn't good enough, or if it was more like, you're a girl, why don't you go and play softball? Mm-hmm. I did play softball for a little bit, fucking hated it. And it was just like, this is not what I actually wanted to do. So
no, I hate the pitching. I hate the size of the ball was just uncomfortable. Everything about it is just awkward.
It's a different game, and it employs slightly different skills. You know, it's similar, but it employs slightly different skills. And I've seen, you know, women's softball pitchers are crazy. They're fantastic. Like, but it's not what I wanted to play. It wasn't something that I actually wanted to do. I'm like you. I love baseball. Go Yankees.
Yeah, I don't want to disparage softball because I think that I have so much respect for anybody who does sports on that level, but it just wasn't for me.
Yeah. Just not what I want to play. Yeah, I hate the size of the ball. Fucking hate it. Like, it's just like, no, this is, what is this? This is, you kick it. This is something you kick, not throw.
Right. Exactly. Can I just bump this over a net? Anyway.
I don't remember what I was going to say about the movie now. Sorry. There's something about the movie because I got sidetracked with my own childhood experience. Yeah, the interesting thing I think for me is that this film didn't, I think because they had to play in skirts, I was just like, nope, I'm not interested. And because doing anything in a skirt, especially when I was a child, I was just like, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. And I still am like that. You know, you can wear the dresses, but please don't make me. But it is this whole emphasis on the fact that, you know, you're going to go and do this and then the men are going to come back. And this is not serious. This isn't real. Right. And the way that the women, you know, for this brief moment are pushing back against that, it's just like, this is serious. We are actual athletes. And it feeds back into, you know, some of the conversations that we've even had about women's sports recently, where it's, there's always been this attitude of like, particularly team sports, women's team sports are not real, right? The WNBA is not real. Women's softball is not real. Women's hockey is not real. It's a lesser thing than the men's sports, which are actual real sports.
Yeah. Look at what happens with women's soccer.
Yeah, exactly. A couple
years ago. Yeah.
And it's still true like that. And we're moving ahead and moving out of that a lot of the time, but there's still this massive battle. And one of the interesting things about A League of Their Own is that it very much takes the women's side. It's very much like, this is a real sport. These are real athletes playing baseball in a really tough way. And it did lead me into like looking at the fact that women were eventually, I believe, banned from actually playing Major League Baseball. In part because a female pitcher struck out the starting lineup of the New York Yankees in the 1930s, right? And these people like Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
And so this occasioned like this 18-year-old female pitcher. And there's been all of this argument about like, well, did she actually do it? She's like, yeah, she did. She struck out Babe Ruth.
Yeah.
And it's again that kind of like that unwillingness, especially in a patriarchal culture, to except that women not only can do what men can do sometimes, not always, right? Everybody has different talents, but also we can compete with men, actually compete with men, and that men are not naturally better. Men are not naturally better at baseball than women. And that's something that I think that this film does actually very clearly address. One of the other things that that the film has been somewhat criticized for is the fact that it doesn't openly address issues of sexuality, which is something
that is true.
Which is something that the, and I don't think they could have. This was talked about when the television show came out. Could the film have addressed the sexuality of some of the players? Not really. Not in 1992. It would have been a major uphill battle, especially maybe a smaller film could have, but especially at the level that this film is at. These are big stars. This is very much a mainstream film. It's very much a uplifting sports drama. And
I mean, it was going to be several years before Rosie O'Donnell even could come out, like probably 10 more years before she even could come out, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. And maybe even more than that. I don't know when she actually like publicly,
not sure.
You know, it was one of those kind of obvious, but she never publicly said, that she was gay, but yeah,
it was 2002. It was exactly 10 years later.
Okay. 10 years later. There you go. But it is one of those that like in watching the film, it's like, it's there. The subtext is there, particularly the relationship between the Rose O'Donnell character and Madonna. Who I enjoy greatly in this film. She gets some criticism for it. She's like, I like her. I think she's great.
Oh, yeah. I thought she was perfect for that part.
All the way May. But it's an interesting issue because it is one of those times where you're like, if this had been made 10 years later, maybe. And I'm very glad that when they do the updated version with the television show that they actually, you know, it's openly about these women's sexuality, as well as about baseball and race.
Yeah.
So the other element is the race issue. Do you have any thoughts on that? doesn't really address it.
No, it really doesn't. I think it sort of almost kind of, and I'm not giving it any credit, I'm just saying like it almost kind of touches on it a little bit, because there is a scene where a Black woman is at the stadium and ball comes toward her and I think Dottie's just like, oh, toss it to me. And she's not very far away. And this woman just hurls it. And it's like, whoa, that lady has an arm. And the woman in that scene, I think it's supposed to be, she was someone who had tried out for the league, but wasn't allowed because of racism. And they never actually address that the reason that all of the that there are no black players in this league is because they were not allowed to be there.
Yeah.
And I do think that that's one thing where at, in 1992, they very much could have said that. But I think that they didn't want to turn. I think they, the goal of this movie was to tell the story about these women and the league as it was. And when you start getting into also they were super racist because it was the 1940s, it just it changes the story that you're telling and it changes the pace of it as well. And so I think that that was Penny Marshall trying to acknowledge, making this nod of like, yeah, there were other people that should have gotten the opportunity to be here that weren't.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point. And it doesn't, like you say, it doesn't take away from the film. And it's one of those things, those aspects that, especially if you know the history of the time period, it's like, this isn't being addressed.
Right.
And it would be cool if it was. But again, it's one of the, I don't mean to keep on going back to the television show, but one of the things I really liked about the TV show is that it's not a correction of the film. It's kind of working in tandem with the film.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. is developing things that the film either couldn't or didn't develop.
Yeah.
And so both of the stories that are this, it's the same story in a lot of ways. But both of the stories are actually like really, really working together. Another television mm-hmm. show that should have gotten its final season.
Still so mad about it.
I'm very upset. Fuck you, Amazon. Still a great show though. People should watch it. Yes. So any other thoughts about A League of Their Own other than the fact that it's amazing? And if people have not seen A League of Their Own, I am horrified and I want to know what you have been doing with your lives that you've not seen this film.
Yeah. My only other thought that I wanted to share is that it will never be okay with me that this movie got completely shut out for awards. It did not get any Oscar nominations at all. It should have gotten a number of them. And that it's always bothered me. This should have been Tom Hanks should have been supporting actor. Gina Davis should have gotten best actors. It should have gotten screenplay. It should have gotten so many things and it did not. And that is not okay.
100% agree.
Still bitter.
So yeah, I mean, I think A League of Their Own is just, it's so iconic. And again, the fact that Penny Marshall made comparatively fairly few films in her career, but so many of them are so, they're mainstream films, but they're so well made. Like you said, I'm glad that you pointed out this whole understanding of story structure and comedy. And the way that that she like is able to communicate that through film, she's so sharp about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's why these films work so well, because she's so good at that structure.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think that that's going to close us out for this week. Probably anything else to say about Penny Marshall?
Well, she did have one film that was nominated for Best Picture. That was Awakenings in 1990.
That's right. Yeah.
Starring Robin Williams and Robert De Niro. And she was not nominated for Best Director. I'm still mad about that too. But I did want to acknowledge, we chose not to do that one today. We wanted to do some of the lighter stuff because Awakenings, it's a sweet movie, but it's pretty heavy. About doctors and stuff. And it's kind of a downer, but also an excellent movie. Riding Cars with Boys, I think, is one that when it was released, it did not get the reception that it deserved. And it's also a very good one. And also I think, you know, I don't necessarily think that we needed a remake of The Bishop's Wife, but I love what Penny Marshall gave us in The Preacher's Wife. I love that movie. I think it's another one. It's like an underrated Christmas movie that should get seen more, with Denzel Washington and Whitney Houston and Courtney B. Vance. It's a good one. She's just a good director who's made good movies. She doesn't have a miss in her filmography.
Yeah, she really has. I haven't actually seen The Preacher's Wife.
You haven't? Oh, I haven't. I think you'd like it. I think you'd like it. It's, she does enough to make it feel like it's something separate. It's definitely the same story with Cary Grant, but it's it it justifies its existence, I think, really well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. I'm going to have to check it out.
You should.
My dog is just like... You might not be able to hear him, but he's now like making his little bark howl, and I'm just like,
I can hear little bits every once in a while, and I'm just like, oh, I bet that's so loud in your apartment.
the last time he started barking, I was on a Zoom call, and I was like, and my client was like, how, it's like, what kind of dog do you have? And she was like, so he's small? I was like, yeah, he's short. He is not a big dog. Like, he just has a big dog bark. He does his big dog bark, and he sounds like he's three times his actual size.
He's a short king.
He very much is. It's like, it's that German shepherd, and it was like, whoa.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
Anyways, all right. So I think that is going to close us out for this week. Thank you all so much for listening. And as always, we want to thank our lovely patrons, who include Abby, Ali, Brian, Connor, Estefania, Heather, James, Judy, Carriata, Matt, Michelle, Monty, Nanina, Robert, Steve, Sharon, and Tao. Thank you so much for continuing to support us, you guys. If anyone is still owed buttons, etc., please let me know. I think I've got everybody now. But you know, if you still haven't received them, please like inform me, because you should have. If you want to join their number, our Patreon is patreon.com/citizendame, and you get fun little things like buttons and stickers, as well as access to our episodes early and some fun bonus episodes as well. We also have our Etsy store. It's etsy.com/shop/citizendamepod. And we do have a Ko-Fi, ko-fi.com/citizendame. Our website is citizendamepod.com, where there are reviews and commentaries and editorials and fun things. I know that Karen has some new reviews up there. And so you should definitely check that out. And you can also get in touch with us a multitude of ways. Our email is citizendamepod@gmail.com. And we are also on Twitter, Instagram, and Blue Sky at citizendamepod. And we are a Letterboxd HQ at citizendame. And you can access our lists, the list of the films that we talk about, as well as articles, links to the podcast, et cetera. And that's at citizendame. So you can also get in touch with us individually. Karen, where are you?
I am on all the socials, most especially Instagram and Letterboxd at Karen M. Peterson.
And I am on Instagram and Letterboxd at LH Business. So that will close us out for this week. Thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
Why don't you leave her alone, Jimmy?
Oh, you zip it, Doris. Rogers Hornsby was my manager, and he called me a talking pile of pig shit. And that was when my parents drove all the way down from Michigan to see me play the game. And did I cry?
No.
No. No. And you know why?
No.
Because there's no crying in baseball. There's no crying in baseball. No crying.
What's the matter, Jimmy?
She's crying, sir.
I didn't mean to do that.
Perhaps you chastise her too vehemently. Good rule of thumb. Treat each of these girls as you would treat your mother.
Anyone ever tell you look like a penis with a little hat on?